following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Oh, once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
Just a little bit of jazz.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
What do you
think?
Just I
like
love
that.
It. That was great. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Somebody's laughing.
Big laughs out in the hall.
Okay. So welcome, welcome, welcome to a, what day is today? Tuesday. I'm a little off because I don't sleep at night, but I'm also pumped because it's the first day of spring. Spring has sprung and Springsteen has begun again, too, or will tonight. See how it all comes together. Bruce Springsteen kicking off the resumption of his tour tonight in Phoenix, and I will be there. I just thought I'd start out that way because Jason Leopold is here. And I know, Jason, you're going to be seeing Bruce in a couple of weeks,
I
right?
am. a few weeks at the Forum here in L.A.
Yes.
This was a show that was supposed to be last year but was rescheduled.
That's right.
So I'm actually glad it's rescheduled for in warmer weather.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I've seen Springsteen probably like you, you know, a bunch of times.
Yep.
But I'm trying to think one of the first times I saw him in LA was when he opened the Staples Center.
Oh, wow.
So the opening of the Staples Center before they even had any, you know, sports there, teams there. Springsteen opened it up with I don't know if it was a week or what, but that I got to say that was just such an amazing show.
I was already gone by then, but I had seen Bruce. Yeah. You know, it was a thing. He never liked playing the Forum, which I guess is where he's playing in a couple of weeks. But he used to play the Sports Arena, which was a dump. It was right next to the Coliseum, and it was an old decrepit building, but I guess it sounded better to him than the Forum did. So,
it's got that grit.
It's gritty. Yeah, it is gritty.
It is gritty.
So I'm surprised he's playing the Forum. Down here, you know, I'm now in Phoenix. And first of all, Joe Biden's in town today. You know, we saw Jamie Raskin over the weekend on Sunday.
I saw that you posted a picture.
Not only a picture, I videotaped his speech. He spoke for about 30 minutes. And I wasn't planning to, you know, tape the whole thing. I thought I'll get a few minutes on. And when he slows down, I'll turn it off. He never slowed down. It was a brilliant speech. And he did it off the cuff. No notes, no nothing. It was so good that I knew I was going to play it back on yesterday's show. But on Sunday, I had dubbed it or downloaded it and got it ready for broadcast. And I thought, this is just too good. I'm not going to wait. I'm going to put it up on YouTube. I put that up Sunday night. It is now Tuesday afternoon. There's already 10,000 downloads of this video. And the comments are nonstop. People just creaming over Jamie Raskin. Yeah. And I get it because I adore him. I think he's great. And I think he's the best we've got. I hope the party is taking notice. I've never seen a response like this to a political speech.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, Jason, you froze. I'm having
I look here. I look okay.
You look okay to me too, but I'm having YouTube messes with me, but you are, you're frozen. I'm sure you'll unfreeze in a minute. Anyway, so Jason Leopold is here. Now, here's the thing. You've got a new newsletter up.
Yes. It's
through Bloomberg News, where you're working now. So people can subscribe. And in fact, if those of her are watching on video, I put the URL to subscribe to the FOIA Files newsletter up on the Chyron under your frozen picture there, Jason.
Am I still frozen?
You're still frozen.
Can I like leave and come back?
You can. You want to try that?
Sure. Okay. I'll try. I'll be right
back.
You do
that. Okay. So, well,
don't go anywhere, Nicole.
I'm not going anywhere. I'm just going to move the picture Okay. So he's gone and he'll come back in so I can do a reset, as they say. So Jason Leopold. So here's what happened. Jason launched this new newsletter. The second week, just okay. I see you now. Hold on. Let me bring you back on. Okay, you're moving again. So I was just there. You go. You're back. So I was just telling the people that you launched the newsletter. The second edition just came out on Monday. So they come out on Mondays, right? Monday.
Actually, it comes out on Fridays.
Oh, on Friday. Oh, okay.
On FOIA Fridays.
FOIA Fridays. Makes
FOIA
sense.
FOIA Fridays. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I knew that because I talked about this with Marcy Wheeler, who's now on with me every Friday, you know.
Amazing.
We do Empty Wheel Fridays here on the show. And with everything that's going on, you know, it's a good way to unpack what went on during the week. And she's unparalleled. Right. She's awesome. So that's right. So I had read it on Friday, what your big scoop was. So. Yeah. The news broke that you were going to launch this newsletter, and I got the first one, and I texted you. First, I emailed you, and I didn't hear back. And then I texted you, and you said, sorry, I missed your email. I'm out on a story. I don't have my phone. I'm using a burner phone, so sorry I missed. But yes, I'll come on, and I'm working on this big scoop. So that's what came out on Friday is... Yeah. This scoop. So tell us what happened. Go ahead.
Well, first, let me just say, as far as the newsletter is concerned, as you know, Nicole, better than anyone, I file Freedom of Information Act requests multiple times per week. So I am up to 9,000 FOIA requests that I filed, you know, against or with federal and state agencies. I filed more than 150 lawsuits against the federal government. For a wide range of documents. So I'm constantly getting records, but I don't have a place to put those, you know, records in a sense. As far as the story, not every single document I get sort of fits onto, you know, the website as its own standalone story. So I had this idea a couple of years ago, why don't I just have a newsletter, right? Where I can, then it can become a home for all of my documents, and I don't have to kind of fuss around with figuring out where it should live. Mm-hmm. So that's what this newsletter is. It's called FOIA Files, FOIA, FYA, Freedom of Information Act. Comes out every Friday. It's a free newsletter. People can sign up over at Bloomberg.
Right.
And it's free because one, or at least for the time being while I'm still working here, I want to share these documents with everyone. I wanted to bring people behind the scenes and tell them about, you know, stories that are going on and inside of government agencies. I want to like lay bare waste, fraud, and abuse, and inform people about things they otherwise may not know about if not for the documents. So the second edition installment came out on Friday, and it's based on these FBI documents that I've been, you know, working really aggressively to pry loose from the FBI, a very secretive agency. And I finally got these records, and these records are what were the kind of internal reaction from FBI personnel to the search out of Mar-a-Lago. That was my coworker, Levin. That's who I was looking to.
I figured that.
You know, what the search that took place in August 2022.
Right. A legal search warrant was executed at Mar-a-Lago. Yes. You hear, you know, if you turn on Fox, they raided Mar-a-Lago. No, they executed a search warrant. Okay.
Right. Exactly. Yes. It was legal. It was all, you know, done through official channels. And I wanted to know, just because I was curious, really, what was the reaction behind the scenes within the FBI to this search? And I finally got these documents along with other, you know, sets of documents from the FBI related to any violent threats that were aimed at FBI personnel. And these documents are pretty remarkable, Nicole. One, because it really brings you behind the scenes to get a sense of what was happening and what is happening, perhaps, inside the FBI, provides some very, very, very colorful detail and commentary by FBI personnel as to what they thought about it. And you may have that article over there, but the, you know, I included, you know, screenshots of these emails. Yes. And these are basically what it amounts to is some FBI personnel reacted and sent emails to the FBI ombudsman. And the FBI ombudsman is sort of like the, you know, the person that you can go to complain to. You can lodge complaints, concerns, you know, with this person. And, you know, basically one of the first documents that I opened up was an email to Chauncet Moray, who is the FBI ombudsman. And of course, you know, the FBI employee's email is redacted.
Yep.
And the email says, did this really just happen? Am I dreaming?
Yeah.
The FBI served a search warrant on a former president. If he took documents, give him a call and ask for them back. Like, seriously? My own agency? A bunch of Democrat political hacks up top. I've lost just about all faith in our leadership. And that was an email that was sent August 11th, 2022.
Okay, right? But what we know, though, we know that they asked and they asked and they asked and they asked.
Exactly, yes. And that's, you know, obviously very clear that that's what, you know, that's what we learned later on is that they did, in fact, ask. But the idea that, you know, that one, that this stoked that kind of reaction, and it wasn't just this one, it was, you know, another reaction where, you know, one employee, you know, characterized the Bureau as a banana republic, an embarrassment, you know, and then demanded, you know, answers to a series of questions. You know, what is the predication of the investigation involving the search? It better be more than putting a few documents in the archives or classified material of which the man could have declassed.
Oh my God.
It goes on and on. And you, as you know, the readers and the public are now being brought inside the Bureau. And there's always been rumors about the Bureau being, you know, at least parts of the Bureau being sympathetic to Trump and sympathetic to, you know, certain political causes. But this is so detailed, you know, and we haven't really seen this kind of detail. And to see it in documents is, you know, is very different than anonymous sources are saying that this is what the FBI is doing, right? You get to actually now see the primary source material from this. So, you know, and this, you know, this kind of reaction was sent by the ombudsman, you know, these concerned emails to other top officials at the FBI and ultimately made its way to, you know, FBI Director Chris Wray.
Right.
But in addition to that, right, to kind of get a full picture here, there's another email that I obtained that I included here, and it relates to kind of like the tone around, you know, what's happening inside the FBI as it relates to January 6th and all the various civil unrest that was taking place, you know, in the country. And this one email, as it relates to January 6th, starts off, you know, there's no way good way to say it. So I'll just be direct. From my firsthand and secondhand information from conversations since January 6th, there is, at best, a sizable percentage of the employee population that felt sympathetic to the group that stormed the Capitol.
Yeah.
And it was no different than the BLM Black Lives Matter protests of last summer.
Oh my
That's
God.
What another FBI agent, you know, wrote.
Right.
He went on to summarize his views of the climate at FBI offices, you know, based on his conversations with colleagues. And he said agents, especially agents who worked counterterrorism cases, sympathized with the insurrectionists' frustration and chalked it up to, quote, everyone having been quarantined at home for months, end quote, due to COVID, losing their jobs and fake news.
And so fake news, right.
It was really, really, you know, remarkable to, you know, to see this. And so the FBI, you know, because the FBI needed to react to this or needed to respond to this rather. So his director, Chris Wray, was getting, you know, pummeled by Republicans, by his own workforce. And so the FBI, you know, then sets up this this interview between Director Wray and the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
In an attempt to, quote, humanize him.
Oh, my God. And so he went on damage control. The first thing that popped into my mind, other than we knew it, is, you know, all you hear from them being the Trumpers and Republicans, the deep state, they've infiltrated. They got the deep state. They're all doing. Yeah. The deep state is working for the goddamn Republicans.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's what the sort of tension was here too, because on the one hand, right, these FBI personnel were really, you know, coming across as very sympathetic, right? And at the same time saying their actions, because they had to, search Mar-a-Lago for these classified records that Trump took there, that now they were being subjected to violent threats by the potentially very people that they may have been sympathizing with. So,
in fact,
that's captured in some of these documents as well.
Right. Didn't you say that they knew that this was going on? Like they had this information for a couple of weeks, but before Wray could say anything, they had to get security in place because he was under so many threats.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, that's all, you know, captured here. And there's one document or a set of document. Before I get to that, I'm sorry, let me just say that, you know, as I noted here in this newsletter, you know, there's lots of spreadsheets, emails, text messages, much of which also document a series of violent threats. That's how it's characterized in the documents to FBI property personnel and their families after the Mar-a-Lago search. And one employee, you know, writes in this letter, in this email to the ombudsman, people are threatening us more than usual due to the actions of the few. The actions of the few are the government officials who authorized the search to retrieve these records, not the actions of a few people who are, you know,
bad actors
lobbing threats. They're blaming, you know, the people inside of government who authorized this, you know, and the threats are, you know, ended up being very, very real, because if your listeners recall, there was a Navy veteran who was armed, you know, with an AR-15. He went onto social media, you know, days after the search, and said that he would kill federal agents on site. And he ended up in a shootout after he tried to breach a shootout with you know, a state trooper in Ohio after he tried to breach the FBI's Cincinnati field office. So, you know, it's kind of, like I said, just really amazing to get this sense of what is taking place behind the scenes inside the Bureau. And nobody's ever had an opportunity to really kind of take a look at it and to see what, you know, what was happening. I think there are lots of people who have suspected it,
you know?
But now here's some evidence, you know, that you can use to back that up.
Right. And in with these conversations that you got copies of, text exchanges and emails, we find out that there are a lot of FBI operatives who are Trumpers. But they said, so they weren't taking part in the insurrection, but there were police officers, there were military people, there was at least one Secret Service agent, who participated. And is anything, I mean,
I will say this, by the way, just on that note, I've got a little preview for Friday's newsletter.
Yes.
Which, you know, your listeners will want to read and you will want to read is kind of in that area, in that area as well.
Wow.
So some good things that we haven't seen before.
Wow. See, yes, we saw it on the day of the inauguration when so Trump fled. He left, didn't go. And then so the Bidens do the march down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. And when they get there, the door was locked. It was closed. And right. There was nobody standing there. And what the protocol is, there's somebody there to welcome them, let them in. And it was closed and locked. And I'm thinking, those fuckers are all in the tank for Trump, and they did this to send a message. And this is really scary. So I'm surmising, I could be wrong from what you just said, that maybe you've got some stuff on Secret Service, because I think Joe Biden's probably in danger.
Well, it's interesting. I do have a long-running lawsuit against multiple agencies, including Secret Service, for documents related to January 6th. I'm currently fighting with Secret Service because they claim that they can't find anything.
Oh, God.
You know,
well, to get these documents, you had to go overboard. You and Bloomberg filed a lawsuit because they were stalling you, right? They were putting you off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's really, really difficult to pry documents, you know, loose out of the government these days. It's just becoming increasingly difficult. And particularly to then narrow it down and locate the kinds of records that you really want. And I really wanted these records, right. You know? But yeah, I would say that, you know, as it relates to Secret Service, I truly believe that there's a lot more there and a lot more that would shed light on, you know, the events of January 6th, you know, before and after. And I think that is what I have found in many of the records that I have obtained thus far. I've got, you know, stories set up for down the road, particularly from the National Guard, from the Pentagon, where we've heard all these stories about, you know, what they knew and when they knew it. Mm-hmm. But with these records, you can really kind of tell, you know, a narrative. You can really kind of, you know, see what, you know, what the evidence is and exactly what they really did know and when did they know it and how they reacted. And it's interesting because, as you know, that as far as January 6th, there's still prosecutions taking place, right?
Yeah.
People are still being charged 4 years later. And it is, you know, it's still very relevant.
Well, of course it is. And I'll tell you something that frightens me is I have no belief, you know, Donald Trump is losing donors, losing supporters, that, you know, in the primaries, we're seeing a good portion of people who still call themselves Republicans voting against him. It doesn't bode well for him. And I have no belief or even inkling that he will win legitimately. But I have no doubt that he's got some tricks up his sleeve. And I just heard a statement that he made that really, really scares me. And what he said was, let me see if I have it here. Did I pull? Yeah. So listen, he's speaking, doing an interview with, I think, Nigel Farage. Why? I don't know. But listen to this clip.
There was a lot of cheating going on, and we're going to get that cheating stopped, to work on that. I say to my people, don't worry about the votes. We got plenty of votes. You just make sure during that period, it used to be one day. Now it's 40 days and 45 days and 48 days.
Don't worry about the vote. We've got plenty of votes, which makes me believe that, oh, my God. So he's got something nefarious going on. If you've got all these people in various agencies throughout the government, there's your deep state. I put nothing past him. I know he's not going to go quietly.
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't think that's a revelation in the sense that, you know, there's going to be any sort of concession, if you will, if in fact, you know, Biden, you know, wins a second term. We didn't see it the first time around, right? So I kind of doubt that you'd see it the second time around. But you know,
saying don't worry about the vote, we've got plenty of votes. What the hell?
And it's just in terms of the, you know, the rhetoric, the violence that we're, you know, that I was able to kind of unpack here in some of these documents. I mean, I think that it is, you know, noteworthy and of what could possibly, you know, take place later on this summer. The, you know, as I mentioned in the newsletter, there was supposed to be a point in time where, you know, a trial was supposed to take place, right? Because he's already been charged. But that is continuously getting moved and moved and moved. So at this point, you know, it becomes unclear, you know, when that's actually going to happen.
Right. And again, you know, the Aileen Cannon, I guess there was a hearing today that Trump was at. I haven't really seen what's going on today. But, you know, she I saw an interesting comment from, I forget who it was, somebody on Shitter or one of the social media sites said, you know, it's easy to think that there's, you know, all this nefarious stuff going on, and there probably is. But for Donald Trump, a lot of it is just, you know, or Eileen Cannon, a lot of it is just incompetence. Yeah, she probably would try to help him if she could. But like this thing she did the other day with the Presidential Documents Act, it's not a thing. It has nothing to do with what Trump's, and she's making shit up to go along with his narrative and saying, oh, hold on, somebody is calling and they shouldn't be right now. Oh, you know what? Spocko's calling. I don't know why, but let's find out why. Hey, Spocko, Jason's only got a couple more minutes. So did you want to ask him a question?
Yes. Specifically, does he have any examples of the FBI failing to follow up on threats of violence and dismissing them? Because this is a big topic that I really want to get into, is to show that it's a huge failure on the FBI to follow up on threats from MAGA people.
Good question.
That is a good question. I don't know if I have, honestly, anything where they have received threats or received evidence of it and just failed to follow up. I'll take a look at that. What I do have, though, at least in sort of the larger, you know, bigger picture, is and certainly as it relates to January 6th, is, you know, lots of agencies who have received warnings, but just kind of didn't take any action, you know, when January 6th rolled around. So that's kind of, you know, that continuously kind of gets buried. Certainly the, you know, the January 6th, the committee that investigated, you know, in Congress, the events of January 6th, they've noted that, but I do have those documents. I haven't really seen, I'm not sure if I've seen anything in FBI documents, but I will take a look.
I'm looking for specific failures because recently the threats to the judges, all these judges, Engoron just got some more, and there is no task force like they have for the election, you know, threats task force.
Right.
But I'd like to know, hear about why they dismiss them, who's dismissing them, and their failure that Barb McQuaid's book, she talks about the failure reluctance to investigate. And I'd like to know, get some examples.
Oh, that's very interesting. I was unaware that she documented that in her book, which I'll have to check out. But, you know, it would be, and certainly FBI may, you know, be involved, but it would be the U.S. Marshal Service that would take the lead on sort of handling or responding to or investigating some of these threats to judges.
I guess we'll wait and see. But I hate to wait and then have somebody follow through on one of these threats. We know that the threats are off the charts. And I do wonder what law enforcement is doing, especially the parts of law enforcement that are sympathetic to Trump.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it's something that has long been, you know, an interest of mine, and to see what that response is in documents, because it's very, very different. I would never be able to get a, you know, a quote from someone that says, "Am I dreaming? Did this just really happen?"
Right.
You know, I mean, that,
and they're talking about a search warrant being and do they not know the background? Like, yes, they did. The National Archives has been trying for the better part of a year to get these documents.
Exactly.
That is really just, my jaw dropped when I read that. And so people should go subscribe to the newsletter. And so will they be able to see the first two if they subscribe today?
Yes, they will. Yeah. Yeah, they absolutely will. It's also, you know, it'll be there on the website, but it's easy. You'll get an email.
Yep.
Confirm that you subscribed.
And yep. And then it shows up in your inbox. And exactly. Lots of great stuff there. I know you need to run.
Yes.
Jason, it's always great to talk to you. And, you know, my timing on this was great.
I know that we're closer in, you know, geography now. So we
are. Well, you know what? I don't know when we spoke about my friend, Angela McCluskey. Yes. And it turns out you and your wife knew her as well. I don't know when they're going to have a memorial for her, but it will be sometime soon. And of course, I'm going to come in for that. So. You know, maybe I'll see you.
Yeah. My wife and I, my wife worked with her. Mm. My wife's in the music business and, you know, she worked on soundtracks, but she worked on a movie called Flirting with Disaster.
Oh, sure. I remember that one.
Yeah. And Angela, I don't know if it was with Wild Colonials, but worked on the soundtrack. Uh-huh.
You know, they've done a lot of music for film. Angela's husband, Paul Cantillon, scores a ton. I mean, he's an amazing classically trained pianist. But they put out a Wild Colonials album called Real Life, I think volume two for whatever reason. That was all music that was in films. So
which is great.
Yep.
It feels like we're losing a lot of our, you know, heroes and artists. And
no, that's why, you know, you got to, I said to... a friend of mine who knew Angela, who's a big rock and roll star. He's like probably my friend, you know, the most famous friend that I have in the music industry. And I know Angela was his social director too. She introduced him to his girlfriend of like 5 years after, and then she left him and went to be with Neil Young, but that's another story. But I texted him as soon as I heard the news. I'm like, I know that you loved her too. I don't know who else to talk to. I was just like, it's overwhelming. And I said, we need to reach out to the people we love and tell them we love them, because you may not get another chance. Angela, you know, I was supposed to do that Women Who Rock thing, and Angela and I were going to do an interview, and we had it set, wasn't a good day. She's like, well, is it happening right now? I said, no, we can put it off. We'll do it another time. And now there is no other time. So, you know, tell people that you know, that you love them. Yeah. So
it's the truth.
Really is. Cause it's not easy.
Well, love you, Nicole.
I love you too, Jason. And I will see you when I come in. I'll talk to you off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Talk soon.
Definitely. All right.
Mwah. Take care.
Love you.
Bye.
Bye. Jason Leopold, everybody. He is doing great work over at Bloomberg. And now get this newsletter. Just go to Bloomberg.com. I put the thing up on the Chiron. I'll put it in the chat as well. I mean, in the blog when I post. Oh, my God. I did not sleep last night. And I'm half brain dead. And Spocko, you still there? No, I think Spocko's gone. So
I'm here.
Oh, you are there. Hi. Yeah. So I know he didn't give you the answer you wanted, but you gave him food for thought.
Well, it is the kind of thing I was also going to say, ask him about, his Secret Service, side of it, because the Secret Service was the organization that evaluated who the groups were, who were attending January 6th, deciding whether or not they were a threat.
Right.
And I know from the research and reading about this from the January 6th committee that they dismissed groups like the Proud Boys as nonviolent, and in some cases said that they were allies.
Oh, my God. Allies of Trump.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Well, what Jason said is this Friday, the newsletter that's coming up this Friday, it deals with the Secret Service.
Well, you know, the other thing about the Secret Service is, and I've written about this, is the guy who used to be Trump's head of his body, his presidential detail for security, Tony Ornato, he became Trump's head assistant deputy chief of staff. And his job was overseeing Trump's rallies. So that was in the rally. I did a lot of research. The rally was one of the places that COVID spread. And part of it was through the Secret Service, because Trump didn't like them wearing masks. And the Secret Service, the agents were like complaining, like, I'm going to get my family sick. And Carol Leon talked about this. And I remember you had a guest on the show, the co-writer of Carol's book on the Secret Service. What was his name?
Philip Bump.
Yeah. And he... One of the questions that Carol and they revealed was that the Secret Service was telling people, don't get tested, go back to DC, don't get tested here, because that will then show that all you people are sick. And it was somebody within Trump campaign, I think it would either be Meadows or his campaign advisor at the time, not Manafort, Pascal, okay. Brad Pascal, who basically told the traveling nurses and the head of the White House medical units to stop the testing. Don't test people anymore. Stop them. We don't want anybody to know how many contaminated people are here. So that was one of the cases, and that's against both federal law, the executive order law in the state of Oklahoma about reporting testing immediately to the state so they can deal with the quarantine, and they covered it up. Now, that wasn't Pill Popper in charge at the time.
You know
it was
what?
The other doctor, but still, it's it's not obstruction of justice, obstruction of pandemic orders to protect the public. And Carol Leon later went on to do a story about how many Secret Service people were infected, what they tried to do to stop it. And that got covered up as well under the category of Secret Service protected information and, you know, HIPAA rules. So crew asked for that information and they never really got the details. But this is very clear. The Secret Service, part of it was because of Trump's buddy, Tony Renato, but also they didn't like being contaminated and they were basically forced to do it.
Wow. Wow. So, well, Spocko, since you brought up Doc Ronnie, and I didn't start the show with, you know, with a goofy song or anything. You can tell I've been feverishly looking for this one because Patrick Fitzgerald did one of his song parodies in honor of Doc Ronnie, who got the nickname the Candy Man. So we could use a little levity right now.
Cool.
So here we go. Patrick Fitzgerald.
Okay, the White House. Sprinkle it in pills.
Oh, hold on.
Whoops. Keep folks away.
Hold on. I was watching. I was watching a video about an art thing, and I put it up on you know, to go fast so I could get through it quickly. So let's back this up and play it at the right speed.
Who can take the White House? Sprinkle it in pills. Keep our folks awake so they can pass some right-wing bills. The Candyman. The Candyman can. The Candyman can, 'cause he brings in all the drugs to make us all feel good. Who can be a doctor? Prescribe amphetamine. Then when you weigh the president, just write down 215.
The Candyman.
The Candyman. The Candyman can. The Candyman can, 'cause he brings in all the drugs and make us all feel good. Ronnie Jackson thinks all the booze he drinks is satisfying and delicious. When he's drunk, he gets quite vicious. He will even turn seditious.
Had to pull down the video because I'd get copyright violated. Because they're using the video from a movie.
Rank.
Can't do that.
Just call him Captain MAGA because of all the booze he drank. Candyman. The Candyman can. Candyman can, 'cause he brings in all the drugs and makes us all feel good. And Ronnie feels good when he's wearing his MAGA hood.
Sorry, you're not seeing the video, but there's Donald Trump wearing his MAGA hat looking in the window of the candy shop. This guy's name is Patrick Fitzgerald. He does these song parodies, and he's really good. But
that was great.
Wasn't
I really
great?
Enjoyed it.
It was, really good.
Rodney Jackson, this is the thing that it came out of the time, and you might have heard this recently. He was demoted from Rear Admiral. Lower half,
yes.
to captain.
Yep.
Because of some of his
behavior.
Behavior, exactly. And at the time when he, and this was after he had, said that Trump was 239 pounds,
and in perfect health,
6'3".
He'd live to be 200.
Yeah.
God, you know what kills me though about this guy Ronnie Jackson is he was Obama's doctor. Did Obama not see who this guy was?
You know, that's really interesting because Trump liked him. And so Trump wanted to make him the head of the VA. And there's so many people that was like, this is a huge mistake that the DOD, the Inspector General, did a whole report on. It was basically to stop him from being the head of the of the VA. So in this report, and this came out in March 2021, he had... They interviewed all of the people. He was a terrible boss, and everybody said it. And he was they called him toxic boss who disparaged, belittled, bullied, and humiliated subordinates while leading the White House medical unit. And somebody said, the worst behavior I've ever seen in my medical career. And included in that were some of his drug things, as well as basically sexually, coming on to one of his staff while he was on a trip. She was drunk. And you read the story and all the interviews was like going, this guy was terrible. He was yelling, screeching, traumas. But the thing is he, what did they call managed up? So they didn't see that. All right. It was only the people underneath it that. We did it. And so when they came out, when they had the opportunity for that, they just nailed him how bad of a boss he was.
Wow. No, the thing, and when I've heard him speak, I mean, the guy is just a lunatic. And so I would love to ask Barack Obama, didn't you notice that he was at least a little off?
And you know how it is with, the bosses not seeing it versus the people underneath it seeing that kind of attitude.
I wonder if the other people saw it, if they knew who Ronnie Jackson was before, Trump came into office and he showed his true colors.
And the thing is also about what I did not know is that the person who was the president's physician is also the head of the White House medical unit,
right,
which is a very much, administrative type task. I know he has other people working on it. But when I tried to get some information from that particular unit about what they were doing, and this is, maybe we could ask Jason to look into it. During the time of COVID, when Trump had his rally, there were people who worked for the White House medical unit who did the testing of all the VIPs who came to the rallies.
Right.
And they either had their own people doing the testing, and then they would have somebody, they hired visiting nurses to do this in Tulsa. And what I found out was, because they are traveling around the country, that the laws about reporting that they have, they could say they would do it like in Washington, D.C. or something like that instead of the state that they were in. So like they go to a rally in Oklahoma and they find all these people who got COVID. It should be reported to the local state COVID officials in Tulsa in Oklahoma, but they didn't. They went back to DC and they held off all that information. And here's the other Secret Service connection. The Secret Service knows everybody who's going to be meeting with Trump. They just have to. They have to screen them. They have to know who they are, where they're meeting with him, when they're meeting with him. They have all of that data. Now, if any of these people were infected, it would be easy to trace them once they know they're infected and say, who else did they meet with? What groups were they with? So Tony Ornato and the Secret Service picked up the contact tracing and they wouldn't share it with the people in Tulsa. Okay.
Yeah.
The public health people needed that data at the time so they could say, hey, this person who's traveling on the plane with Trump or who are celebrities, they need to quarantine because they've got COVID. What did they do instead? And I don't know if this is the White House medical unit or if it was Tony Renato. They sent people in a car to drive back to D.C. since they couldn't be on the plane with Trump and infect people. So all of this data existed. It was there. It would be a great way to show exactly who got infected when.
Yeah.
But they didn't reveal it. And I would have liked to have got it. But they, again, I wouldn't be able to get it. But you know who could have? The people in Tulsa. So the people in Tulsa, and I talked to them, Bruce Dart, the people there, they tried and they were stonewalled for days until they finally got it. By that time, it's already spread.
Right. Oh, sorry about that. This is what scares me. And again, since the day of the inauguration, when I saw that there was nobody stationed outside the White House and that the Bidens couldn't get in, I thought, oh my God, the Secret Service is in the tank for Trump. And every time I hear them screaming about the deep state, I go into my opposite world mode again. There's a deep state and they're all Republicans buried at maggots, not just Republicans, because I don't know that there are many regular Republicans left anymore. The ones that are left are the radical nut jobs.
Remember when the Secret Service had all those messages that got accidentally deleted?
Yep. Yeah, all your phones got wiped. Go figure.
Yeah, he's like, well, that was a BS.
Of course.
Process. Yep. But the other thing about this, and I remember when it came up with during the time of the January 6th committee, Carol Leonard had just written the book. So everybody went to her as the go-to source. But they're not always going to tell her everything. I mean, they became like her buddies and stuff.
Right.
What I wanted to know at that time was when they're in this kind of the Secret Service bubble, what was it that the people were aware of and what they were sending messages? Because those messages aren't just to the Secret Service. I mean, the thing that we know is the intelligence communities, not only ours, but other ones, have other ways of getting those messages that were transmitted beyond just their own, internal things. Other people are on the CC list, like, for example, Pence's Secret Service staff. And those people, even if you didn't see the messages, they would have testified to what was the content of those messages and who they came from. But that we never saw that. And then later it became, oh yeah, well, we'll never see this. And I've heard this from other people, which is more, where's your bullshit little button? Bullshit. because we know that the NSA, for example, has all of this kind of material, but they don't want to reveal it to the public because it would be, national security. So we have that information, and it's a farce. It's a fiction that it doesn't exist, and it's a fiction that we can't have exact information. And I think we're waiting for, the Trump trial or something to bring up the hard copies of that, but it's real.
There's so much that we don't know. That's why the work that Jason Leopold does is so important. We wouldn't see. Now we have proof. We have proof that there are people working at the FBI who were, who are so far down this rabbit hole that I wouldn't trust them with my life because they're radicalized. This is exactly what it's radicalization. That's what's happening to people in government who have bought into this bullshit, some of whom participated in January 6th, but without, Freedom of Information Act and the work Jason's doing, we wouldn't know the extent of it. Reading some of these emails that Jason put in the newsletter, your jaw will drop. It is astounding. And the fact that he said, get ready for the next one, it is about the Secret Service. I'm almost afraid to read it.
I'm not afraid, but what I do know is when these things get shared, you'll know that there's people who will go on and, you know, defend them. And this is, in some cases, it's hard to do because, not hard to do, it's easy to do because you want to believe that the Secret Service, like, Biden got rid of the bad guys, okay? Yeah. Well, the bad guys... The guy who was Tony Ornato, yeah. He wasn't fired. He left the Secret Service voluntarily instead of, you know, firing. And he didn't testify, or he kind of testified, but he didn't testify as a Secret Service agent.
Right.
Which is interesting.
Well, it's just like what happened last week where you know, resigned from the DOJ before he testified. So he didn't, he wasn't on the stand. He wasn't at the hearing as an officer or an employee of the federal government, but as a private citizen.
Mm-hmm. And he was coached by the Trump people, which
Shocker.
Is great fun.
Right.
And as somebody who has coached people, our friend Lisa Graves, yeah. before she appeared for Congress, this is actually one of those areas that if people really wanted to, it could be a way to help impeach Kavanaugh. Oh. And I talked to Lisa about this, and I did a whole piece about it, which was Kavanaugh, we talk about him lying in his perjury. Lisa Graves, our friend,
yes.
The person who was, when she was in charge of Senator Leahy's committee on judiciary, they had to vet the various different people who were speaking for federal judgeships. And in that particular case, Kavanaugh spoke in front of the committee. And one of the questions had to do with some documents that he had received that were stolen from Lisa Graves and her committee about some of the investigation that they found. He lied and said, oh, I didn't know that it was confidential or whatever. So he got through. When it came time for his confirmation for Supreme Court, he got asked the same question. And now that data, Lisa's stolen files, were revealed. And it's very clear. It says this is confidential. This was stolen from this committee. And they asked him again, and again he said, well, I didn't think it wasn't confidential or whatever, which is an out-and-out lie, and she knows it, and she wrote a piece, and I'll put a link in the chat there. She wrote a piece in Slate about he lied about this document being stolen. I know, because it was stolen from me.
Mm.
So that was one of the cases, and so I talked to her, and I said, you know, how is it that he can get away with lying because he's under oath? And what do you remember the hearing where they talked about all those questions about what's a devil's triangle and what's spoofing? Do you remember that part?
Yeah.
Okay.
Vaguely.
Well, that was not what it was about. He decided ahead of time what a safe answer would be. It wasn't, you know, sex with three women. It was a drinking game. Okay. Now, when we train people to talk to the media, one of the things we do is we videotape them trying an answer and say, right. Does that sound good? Does that work? And well, that's not that. Well, what's the real story? Okay. The real story is it's, you know, sex with two women like that. Well, let's just say it's a drinking game. Okay. That's the other thing. All right. During that particular session, he would have decided that that was the lie that they were going to tell, intended not to tell the truth. And all of that would have been recorded by the people who were watching this in order to play back and press it again. If nothing else, they could, you know, bring them in to testify. This was a whole area that if people wanted to, they could have gone after and found the people who were training him, the people who were advising him. Most of them were lawyers, but Kellyanne Conway wasn't. All right.
Right.
So she could not have used the client, lawyer client confidentiality. Well, maybe the documents were disappeared by the AV person. A lot of these people, they kept copies of this to protect their own ass later on. Now, I'm very aware of what kind of security you can do, but I also know that this is the kind of video documentation as well as testimonies that would prove that not only did he lie about this last document, he lied about something like what was the drinking game, what it really was. And that's the kind of thing that would make it so that you could have a current lie, not something that happened X numbers of years ago.
I hear you. All right, Spocko, I'm going to wrap this up because we're getting close to the end. Well, I'll talk to you later. Thank you, as always, for your great input. Always appreciate it. Spocko, read him at Digby's place, digbysblog.net, and, of course, on social media. So, all right, so we've got just a couple of minutes left. Today is Election Day. It is the presidential primary day. You know, Jamie Raskin, you know, was here on Sunday. Joe Biden's in town today. Although, sorry, Joe, Bruce Springsteen takes priority over you. So I'm going to see Bruce tonight. He's expecting me. Not really. But yeah, there's that. So I'm in a musical kind of mood, right? I know I'm glossing over the primaries because there's no suspense. We know what's going on. We've played the music from this family over in the UK, the Marsh family. We've watched these kids grow up over the last 4 or 5 years or so. And they have a new one out that I'm going to end with today. And it's about racism. And you know, they put their spin on it, so it's always great. But apparently, we're not the only ones with a lot of bigots running around the country. They have a racism problem in the UK. If you go to the Marsh family on YouTube and you look at this video, you know what, I'll embed it on the blog today with today's show, and go to the YouTube page because they have a whole explanation of what it's about. And it says, there's been a rising tide of racist hatred and antisocial behavior in the UK in recent weeks. And in the last few days, a media wave has broken as politicians have fallen over themselves to try to exploit issues of public order and positioning without damaging their interests. Racism dominated a recent by-election in Rochdale because a candidate was withdrawn on account of inappropriate language. So this is the shit that's going on over there. So the Marsh family said, I got a little song for you. So we'll end with this because I'm going to bolt out of here and go see Springsteen. So enjoy. We'll talk tomorrow. Tomorrow, actually, I've got the author of this book that I haven't spent enough time with at all, called Fighting Mad, Resisting the End of Roe v. Wade. So there are essays from different people in here. So we'll deal with this tomorrow. Okay. For now, I'm going out with music. Enjoy the Marsh family. I'll see you tomorrow, everybody. It's right here. I forgot I got it on this computer. Bye.
Racism is offensive and it's cruel.
And it's cruel.
You can bring it down just by adding rules.
By adding rules.
It's a complex fact of a social mix.
Social mix.
Some don't care and always kind of seem to be pricks.
Seem to be pricks. You know it's not an issue solved by apology.
You've whipped it up now, Tories, can't you see?
Racism is what is going on. It's all up front and the hate is so strong. Racist, can't you see? You'll get whitewashed for a fee. We hope it might be gone, but we're still fighting racism.
Racism is what is going on. Racism is what is going on. Racism.
so diverse.
But their words are pretty see-through, and their actions even worse.
Racist.